Hey, discos. Need a little more Disgraceland in your life? Just a touch to get you through? Yeah, me too. This is the podcast that comes after the podcast. Welcome to Disgraceland, the after party. Welcome to Disgraceland, the after party. This is the third after party episode. Looks like we're really doing this. Thanks for all the feedback and the support. As most of you know, Disgraceland After Party is a new unscripted mini show that I just started about a month ago and that I'm going to bring to you off the cuff on a bi-weekly basis to help bridge the gap between the Disgraceland episodes. For those of you who don't know, this little mini spin-off show is where I briefly discuss the most recent episodes of Disgraceland. Disgraceland subjects who are in the news and share extra content, deleted scenes, and ideas for future episodes. I also answer the occasional email and provide context on music that I'm listening to, books I'm reading, and other culture I'm devouring at the moment, as this seems to be a regular question. Jake, what are you listening to? What are you reading, etc.? So let's get into it. Okay, last week's episode was on Slick Rick, hip-hop icon, he of the inimitable flow. Most people know about Rick's dust-up with Immigration from a few years ago and the whole Free Slick Rick movement that blew up around that. But people don't know about the tormentor that he had and the kidnapping and attempted murder rap that landed him in prison during the height of his career. I was barely aware of this super dramatic backstory, and someone needs to make a movie about this. It's totally over the top. So check out the Disgraceland episode on Slick Rick if you haven't already. It dropped last week. Slick hasn't been in the news lately, but there are a bunch of Disgraceland alum who made news in the past week. Courtney Love apparently saw the Motley Crue movie, The Dirt, and in typical Courtney fashion, pulled no punches in making her opinions on the flick known in an interview with Interview Magazine saying, quote, "We watched the dumbest Netflix film ever called The Dirt. It's so stupid and vile about women and just fucking dumb. We just made jokes. I was like, when's Ozzy going to snort the ant? Then within seconds, he snorted the ant. Then the Nikki Sixx character was like, I have a new girlfriend. She's sweet. She's wonderful. I was like, and her name is Heroin. And 2 seconds later, her name is Heroin. I was killing it. That's Courtney Love. Tommy Lee from Motley Crue, perpetual 14-year-old that he is, responded to Courtney on Twitter with, hey, Courtney, when's your movie coming out? Oh, wait, never. Do I even need to get into how juvenile and stupid this is? I've been thinking about Motley Crue lately because I'm researching the Led Zeppelin episode of Disgraceland. And Zeppelin, as most people know, kind of wrote the playbook for rock and roll excess and debauchery in the 70s. A playbook that Motley Crue picked up on and wrote a couple chapters of their own for in the 80s. However, the difference being, and let's just say up front, that nothing I'm saying here is meant to excuse or promote any of either band's horrible offstage behavior. But the difference, as I see it, is that Led Zeppelin seemed to be in on the joke, whereas Motley Crue, even till today, seems oblivious to the conceit of rock and roll, that it's all just kind of fucking silly, the sex, the drugs, the rock and roll. And Tommy Lee, Nikki Sixx, they seem to regard their days of excess atop rock and roll's apex mountain as something to take seriously, as kind of like, this is how we were, fuck yeah, we're badass, which of course makes the whole thing even more gross. I haven't seen the Motley Crue movie, The Dirt, but from the reaction, it seems to me to be a perfect piece of content. Most people in my feeds shit on it, but they watched it. And in the beginning, the first few days of its release, I noticed celeb musicians teasing it on Twitter, asking their followers if they'd seen it without offering an opinion, as if to dip their toes into the outrage pool of social media to test the waters to see if it was okay to like the movie or not. When in reality, they'd probably already seen it, and despite liking it or not, were at least compelled to talk about it, which is sometimes good enough for any piece of art to compel a reaction. I'm sure the movie as a film is paint by numbers, and I'm sure the excess and debauchery is just enough to give the movie an R rating, but not enough to really get into the darkness that surrounds the type of transgressions Motley Crue trafficked in, because that type of movie is really hard to pull off, and probably too much for the brass at Netflix in 2019. And I can't say I blame them. Who needs the headache? And I'm sure that most everything in the movie is retread story from the excellent Neil Strauss book that the film is based on. A book I read in a day in one sitting. I literally picked it up and could not put it down. a book that Courtney Love no doubt read breathlessly as she was charting her own path through fame and excess, which is why she could easily call on the Aussie and heroin stories as they're first revealed in the book. Motley Crue is a lot of things, and whether you like their music or not, or if you're repelled by their behavior or celebrate it, the one thing you can't accuse them of is of being boring. And though I haven't seen the movie, I'm betting that despite whatever flaws it may have as a film, that the band and their story is entertaining enough to compel people to watch it and to talk about it for years to come. I know this because the story I produced on Motley Crue remains one of the most downloaded Disgraceland episodes. Here's a clip. Nikki didn't care. He was spiraling out of control. It was 1984. Motley Crue's second album, Shout at the Devil, had established them as a band not to be fucked with. Critics hated it, kids loved it, and it was selling big time. And Nicky and the rest of the boys were living the life. But fresh off the road from an epically debaucherous tour with the Prince of Darkness himself, Ozzy Osbourne, Nicky was at loose ends. He'd discovered his girlfriend at the time. Former Runaways guitar player and Five Alarm Smoke Show Lita Ford had been set up with another dude by one of her skeezy punk rock guy friends. And Nicky was pissed. So he grabbed Tommy and a couple 2x4s and headed over to Lita's apartment where he knew her punk rock friend was staying. The two burst in like a heavy metal buddy cop duo and proceeded to beat the punk dude to near death with the 2x4s. Then, it was off to Reseda Country Club. Nicky had dropped Tommy off at his place and picked up a date. He was high on Quaaludes, drunk on Jack, and with this new girl who was hot to trot. And the two pulled into the parking lot and hopped out of the Porsche, but only made it as far as the hood before giving in to their carnal desires. It was broad daylight, and Nicky was fully engaged in intercourse with his date on the hood of his car in the middle of the Reseda Country Club parking lot. A crowd began to gather and started to egg them on. Nice car, dude. Nice dick, dude. Hey, is that Nicky from Motley? It is. Too wild. Nicky, despite the distraction of the crowd and despite his inebriation, brought himself to climax, rolled off his date and onto his back on the hood of his Porsche. With Frank Farina's salami still hard and fully exposed, he looked at the crowd of wastoid metalheads and staring at him, he wondered, who am I? Is this real? Am I really alive? All right, it's June 18th if you're listening to this, the day of its release, and that means next week, June 25th, is April Fool's Day. Say what? Next week's episode is kind of a bit different. I'm releasing slash re-releasing the episode that I previously released on April 1st as an April Fool's joke. The episode is on Jim Morrison of The Doors and his satire. It's not true crime, but that said, it's a lot of fun. You'll hear in the prelude to the ep why I pulled the episode after it had only been live for a couple hours and why I'm choosing to re-release it now. Either way, I hope you dig it. It was a ton of fun to write and to record, and it digs deep into the roots of evil in rock and roll history, touching upon Morrison's obsession with Aleister Crowley, the renowned occultist who is heavily prevalent in the Led Zeppelin episode that I'm currently writing and who makes an appearance in the Norwegian black metal episode, an episode with an alum in the news this past week, Burzum's Varg Vikernes, who was booted off of YouTube. In their effort to cut down on hateful content, YouTube deleted Count Grishnak's Thulean Perspective channel and issued the following statement, quote, "Today we're taking another step in our hate speech policy by specifically prohibiting videos alleging that a group is superior in order to justify discrimination, segregation, or exclusion based on qualities like age, gender, race, caste, religion, sexual orientation, or veteran status. This would include, for example, videos that promote or glorify Nazi ideology, which is inherently discriminatory. Finally, we will remove content denying that well-documented violent events like the Holocaust or the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary took place." And as they should. Later, Varg, you fucking dirtbag. For a little more insight into who Varg Vikernes is and what makes him tick, here's a clip from Disgraceland's episode on Norwegian black metal. The goal for Norwegian black metalheads was to be truly evil, to completely subvert democratic morality, and to banish poser metal bands back to the punk rock ghettos they crawled out of. Euronymous, and the scene he lorded over, had a new charismatic personality, Varg Vikernes, a.k.a. Count Grishnak, the one-man engine behind the new, exciting black metal band, Burzum. Euronymous agreed to release Burzum's records on his Deathlike Silence Productions label. And Varg, through the strength of his Manson-esque gaze and the excitement of his fresh new band, quickly ascended to an unofficial leadership role in the fast-growing scene that now included a flock of new bands like Darkthrone, Immortal, and Enslaved. Varg was committed to the cause as Euronymous and Dead before him, but Varg's commitment infused black metal Satanism with an even more toxic and racist ethno-nationalism. Varg believed Christianity had purged Norway of its heritage by casting aside Norse tradition. He took this shit personally. Varg was out for revenge against Christians, blacks, homosexuals, posers, and basically anyone who wasn't a nihilistic, blue-eyed, pagan metalhead. That's Varg Vikernes from the Norwegian black metal band Burzum. If you can't get enough of Varg and black metal, I've included a chapter in my book on the genre that goes further than the episode, including Euronymous' complicated relationship with Varg and Dead. Also in the book is a chapter on Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses, an artist I haven't yet recorded an episode on, but Axl and his bandmate Duff McKagan show up in the broadcast versions of the Kurt and Courtney episodes. If you heard the podcast version of these eps and didn't hear them on the radio, you missed out on this content. So here's a clip of the deleted for podcast scene on Nirvana featuring Guns N' Roses from the Kurt Cobain episodes. The flight was crowded. Kurt was late to board first class. It was. Kurt was seated next to another junkie rock star from Seattle. And despite what he would have preferred, there was nothing he could do about it. So Kurt Cobain, junkie singer of the biggest band in the world at the time, took a seat next to Seattle native Duff McKagan, junkie bass player for the second biggest band in the world at the time, Guns N' Roses. Kurt was annoyed. This is going to be awkward. Kurt hated Duff singer Axl Rose, and so did Courtney. It was public knowledge. At one point, though, Axl Rose did everything he could to befriend Kurt. He was an early fan of Nirvana, and they shared a record label, and Axl even repped a Nirvana hat in GNR's video for Don't Cry. Early on, Axl was also adamant about bringing Kurt and his band on tour with GNR. But Kurt would have none of it. From the beginning, he had drawn a sharp line of distinction between Nirvana and Guns N' Roses. He criticized the band and their fans in the press, and he refused to return Axl's phone calls. To Kurt, Guns N' Roses were the problem. They were a big, bloated corporate rock band that spouted racist, homophobic, misogynist views in their lyrics. And as far as Kurt was concerned, he not only wanted nothing to do with them, he wanted his band to throw GNR off of the charts and banish them forever to the heavy metal trash ghetto they belonged. But Axl Rose wasn't one to retreat from a fight. He called Kurt a snob in the press, and then, after the Vanity Fair article hit, Axl claimed publicly that Kurt and Courtney were nothing but a pair of junkies, saying that if that baby is born deformed, I think they both ought to go to prison. It all came to a head at MTV's Video Music Awards in 1992. Backstage, the night's performers milled about uncomfortably. Pearl Jam, Eric Clapton, Bryan Adams among them. And that year's host, Dana Carvey, chilled in his dressing room. Howard Stern wrestled with his fart man costume. Mick Jagger couldn't keep his eyes off of Cindy Crawford, and Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love sat quietly holding their newborn, Francis Bean, looking like most first-time parents, disheveled, overtired, and blissful. Kurt may have been blissed out, but he was a tad bummed that The Cure had canceled their performance. Not that it would have mattered much to viewers that night. The Cure were part of Alternative Nation, sure, but Nirvana were at the moment the biggest band on the planet, and their performance was highly anticipated. Another heavily anticipated performance was that of Guns N' Roses frontman Axl Rose and Elton John. And there was a lot riding on it, for Axl anyway. His homophobic slur from the song One in a Million a couple years earlier was still in the minds of many of Axl's detractors, despite Axl's denial to the contrary. Regardless, his appearance that night with the openly gay Elton John was to be a sort of mending of fences between Axl and his critics. Whatever, Kurt still thought he was a meathead. An ignorant redneck who was part of the problem. A blowhard who couldn't keep his mouth shut and whose band hadn't made a note of decent music since their debut 5 years earlier. Plus, Axel was a cheese ball with his mesh half shirts and spandex bike shorts. But what the hell was this guy thinking? He had no sense of fashion, which was weird considering he was dating one of the world's most famous fashion models at the time, Stephanie Seymour, who was on Axel's arm that night backstage as he pranced by Kurt and Courtney in full rock star glam and excess. Courtney couldn't resist. "Hey Axel, will you be Francis Bean's godfather?" Axel lost it, shouting at Kurt, "Shut your bitch up or I'm taking you to the pavement." Kurt didn't miss a beat. He turned to Courtney and sharply said, "Shut up, bitch." Axel was fuming and pulled away by his entourage to cool off. It didn't end there. Later, in an interview with the LGBT publication The Advocate, Kurt called out Axel, calling him a quote, "sexist and a racist and a homophobe." Kurt went on to say, "You can't be on his side and be on our side. I'm sorry that I had to divide it up like this, but it's something you can't ignore. And besides, they can't write good music." Kurt's words stung and the press ate it up. Everyone knew about the beef between Nirvana and Guns N' Roses, and here Kurt was on a plane about to take a seat next to Axl's bass player, Duff McKagan. So there's a little deleted scene for you. If you like that Guns N' Roses dirt, there's more where that came from in the book, which you can pre-order on my site now, disgracelandpod.com/book. Okay, back in a flash.
We'll be right back after this word.
All right, I'm back. And for this segment, I want to get into my favorite part of these after-party episodes where I get to talk to you about what I'm into, what I'm reading, watching, and listening to. Got into some good television over the last couple weeks. Fred Armisen, Bill Hader, and Seth Meyers have a new season of Documentary Now out on Netflix. And I watched the episode entitled Co-op with John Mulaney and Mike Birbiglia. And holy shit, is it funny. Not sure which documentary this is spoofing, but whatever it is, I'm sure they nailed it. Imagine the documentary version of All That Jazz, but with someone way less talented than Bob Fosse at the helm, and you'll get the hilarity that ensues. Mulaney is on another level at the moment. If anyone else on the planet is funnier right now, I'm not sure who it is. Also, I finally started Fleabag Season 1. It's dirty, depraved, and hilarious, and oh my God, are the Brits more fucked up than we are. This one is hard to describe, but if you enjoy smart, raunchy humor with a unique feminist bent, then you should probably check this out. And wear a condom, though. I'm listening to the Nat King Cole Trio, Jerry Garcia Band, Harry Nilsson. My 5-year-old is obsessed, so my wife and I are obviously doing something right. And lots of the mighty Led Zeppelin. And sadly, nothing new this week other than Cardi B. Cardi B, Cardi B, Cardi B, coming soon. I'm reading Zeth Lundy's book from the 33 and a third series on Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. It's great. If you love this classic album, I highly recommend picking up Zeth's book. You'll read it like I read The Dirt in one sitting. All right, how about some listener feedback? This is a review from Apple Podcasts by username Podcast Junkie, 5 stars, entitled "Why See Jake Live." Podcast Junkie says, "It's risky, right, to go see a live presentation of your fave podcast? What if the podcaster doesn't present well in person? What if the way they look doesn't match what is in your mind? What if seeing it in person wrecks your affinity for the author? Yikes, risky. Well, rest assured that if you're lucky enough to have Jake come your way, go see him," all caps. "I saw him in Denver and now I love the podcast even more. Jake has a fabulous, weighty stage presence that really reinforces his smooth radio presence." Radio. "This guy is the real deal. You'll even enjoy him reading from the phone book. Listen to Disgraceland. Think you will love it." Right on, Podcast Junkie. Thank you so much. All right, if you're down and you want to see me, you can see me in San Francisco this weekend, June 21st at Clusterfest. That's on Friday. I'm on at 8 p.m. on the Poke Comedy Stage, and I believe there are tickets still available, which you can grab on my site. Amazing people are performing at this festival, including the aforementioned John Mulaney, The Roots, Fred Armisen, Amy Poehler. I don't even know where to start. There's so much. Just check out the Clusterfest lineup. And if you stick around a bit and keep listening to this podcast, you might even get lucky and hear me read the phone book. All right, guys, I need some advice. Disgraceland listeners, since I did that Elton John interview, I'm now being asked if I'm interested in interviewing other artists. And the answer is no, I'm not. But if I think about it, I am interested in talking to other artists, talking to them, not interviewing them, particularly about some of the themes that I've explored in Disgraceland. And maybe those talks end up as part of this after-party thing that I'm doing. You know, like when my band would play live shows, there was always an after party where you'd sit with your bandmates and friends and other musicians you liked from other bands, and you'd talk about the set, what went well, what went wrong, whatever. What could I talk to musicians about? That's the question. What would you want to hear me talk to them about? Other than like what records they have coming out, their tours and shit that they want to promote. What Disgraceland themed subjects and ideas and concepts could I talk to musicians that you know, that we all know? What would be interesting? Hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or send me an email. Let me know if you have any ideas. Thank you. Now I'm feeling pretty nostalgic, so I want to take a trip back to the mid-80s to Slick Rick's gritty, green, gack-filled streets of Manhattan. And I'd like to read from you from the 9X pages. 9X. Listen close, and you might hear the address and phone number of a particular Columbia student with presidential aspirations, but I digress. Obadiah Salim M, 320 Riverside Drive, 666-1845. Obadiah Haim, 430 West 109th Street, 663-1544. Obego Records Incorporated, 2 Pennsylvania Plaza, 564-5977. Obaid Ali, 400 West 48th Street, 582-3992. Obama B, 339 East 94th Street, 410-2857. Obana Eli, 420 East 54th Street, 759-6328. Obando Maria, 610 West 142nd Street, 862-0377. Obando Carlos, 330 East 39th Street, 972-3214. Obermeyer, Morvello, and Abramowitz, PC, Attorneys at Law.
Quit talking and start mixing.
Cut it!